Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, First Amendment and Federal Funding for Aid Programs Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 20, 2013, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Agency for International Development, the Alliance for Open Society International Incorporated. The question in the case was whether the United States Leadership Against HIV/AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria Act of 2003, which requires an organization to have a policy explicitly opposing prostitution and sex trafficking in order to receive federal funding to provide HIV and AIDS programs overseas, violates the First Amendment. In an opinion delivered by Chief Justice Roberts, the court held by a vote of 6-2 that the policy requirement violates the First Amendment because it compels, as a condition of federal funding, the affirmation of a belief that, by its nature, cannot be confined within the scope of the government program at issue. Justices Kennedy, Ginsburg, Breyer, Alito, and Sotomayor joined the majority opinion. Justice Scalia filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justice Thomas. Justice Kagan took no part in the consideration or the decision of the case. To discuss the case, we have Eric Jaffe, a Washington, D.C. attorney who specializes in appellate litigation. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Jaffe.
Well, hello, this is Eric Jaffe, and I'll give you the rundown on Agency for International Development versus Alliance for Open Society International. For those of you who were not closely following this hot decision, it involves the U.S. government's programs to combat AIDS abroad. The U.S. government does this in a variety of ways, by funding drugs, by funding healthcare for children and families with AIDS, and among other things, and most relevant here, by trying to discourage prostitution and sex trafficking, which is a source of AIDS transmission, particularly among, you can imagine, illegal prostitutes who don't get good healthcare, who aren't looked out for, and whatnot. And in the course of passing this program, there's a condition upon the receipt of federal funds. So federal funds go out to all kinds of nonprofit entities and other sort of quasi-governmental entities to implement these programs, to implement it by handing out the drugs, by providing the health care, and in some instances by providing education, even anti-sex trafficking or anti-prostitution education. The folks in this case are non-governmental organizations, NGOs, that do some of this work, but not all of this work. So primarily they provide health care and AIDS drugs. They don't do the anti-prostitution advocacy themselves, but as a condition for getting any money under the program, they have to sign a pledge saying that they, A, won't use any of the money to advocate prostitution. That's easy. Everyone agrees that that's okay. But B, they have to say it is our explicit policy that we oppose prostitution and sex trafficking. They have to adopt that viewpoint as their own. And while the opinion itself doesn't talk about it much, they actually are not allowed to do anything inconsistent with that statement. And those are the groups that challenge this, saying, look, you know, it's not like we're going to use your money for pro-prostitution purposes, but we don't want to have to say we're anti-prostitution because that pisses off some foreign governments. It annoys the prostitutes who we're trying to actually treat. It annoys lots of people, and it makes our job harder. And in some instances, we may not agree with you. So they challenged this as a First Amendment problem, and the upshot of it is they won by a 6-2 vote. Justice Kagan was not involved because she was still at the SG's office when this was going on, but an opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, joined by Kennedy, Ginsburg, Breyer, Alito, and Sotomayor, and a dissent by Justice Scalia, joined by Justice Thomas. But Chief Justice Roberts held that the condition on funding was an unconstitutional condition in that it compelled the expression of a viewpoint that was not sufficiently tied to the program such that it was a limitation on the program itself, but in fact it was a limitation on the recipient of federal funds rather than on what the recipient could do with federal funds. And as you go through the opinion, the trouble with this area of the law has always been that the cases are terribly inconsistent historically and have no cogent theory. So on the one hand, you have the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, which says you may not condition the receipt of a federal benefit or privilege on a requirement that you give up some constitutional right or do something that would be unconstitutional to compel you to do in the first instance. So basically, you can't make people do something by withholding benefits that you couldn't make them do by forcing them to do it. It's not a very controversial doctrine historically, but in fact, as you apply it, it becomes more and more difficult to apply. So that's on the one side. On the other side is the notion that the federal government gets to pick and choose its programs, and it gets to pay for those that it wants to, and it doesn't have to pay for anything else. So once you're picking and choosing, then obviously you can limit the money to the program that you picked and not give money to something that you didn't pick. And so many programs these days are mixed activities and speech. And at the moment, those programs are speech or have some speech component to them, telling you that you can't do X. We'll only give you money if you don't say X. Sounds like an unconstitutional condition. And so there's a big mess in the case law, and there's cases going both ways, and it's very inconsistent. And at the end of the day, Chief Justice Roberts and the five who joined him basically said the way we're going to reconcile this is by saying that you are allowed to place a speech condition on the use of federal funds. So you may not use this federal money to advocate some view that we don't like, but you may not make the receipt of federal funds conditioned on the person never expressing views you don't like, or alternatively, having to express views that you prefer that they express. So John Doe gets money to pave the street, but you can't say, I'll only give you money to pave the street if you say, go Obama. Some doctor gets money to vaccinate kids, but presumably you can't say, I'll only give you the money to vaccinate kids if you also say you oppose abortion. And so viewed that way, this sort of falls into that category pretty cleanly. The recipients in this case were not, in fact, the folks who were hired to convey the government's anti-prostitution message. They were doing other stuff. They were handing out AIDS drugs. They were giving health care to people who already had AIDS or what have you. They were promoting condom use, things like that. And so it's not like they would be doing something because the government said, we're going to pay you to say X, so don't say not X. No, they were doing something somewhat tangential to it, and the government was trying to stop them from saying things in their private capacities that the government didn't like. Whereas, on the other hand, presumably, if they were the folks who were actually the government's paid spokespersons for trying to discourage prostitution, then this would be a much more direct, and it would be a programmatic definition. It would be what they were being paid to do, and so, of course, the government could say, you have to say this because that's what we're paying you to say. So the trouble with the case law being mixed is that the dissent is actually quite persuasive, because given how mixed the case law is, you could write a persuasive opinion either way. So the dissent points out that the government obviously gets to, well, maybe not so obviously, obviously to the dissent, the government gets to be not viewpoint neutral. The government gets to have an opinion and express that opinion. We'll get back to that in a minute because I think that's where the dissent goes off the rails. But in any event, this is a standard Scalia view for many, many cases where he thinks the government can pick and choose among viewpoints. It does all the time. It adopts highway funds instead of, you know, agricultural funds, or it adopts one military program versus another, or it adopts Obamacare as opposed to funding the Defense Department. Whatever you think the ideological choices are, the government gets to have an opinion. And he makes the very persuasive argument that, you know, look, no one says that we would have to use Hamas to distribute U.S. aid funds, even if they were really efficient at it. The fact that they say things we don't like and don't like the U.S. government is more than enough reason to not have to give Hamas money to hand out U.S. aid funds. And even if Hamas was a U.S. citizens group, presumably the answer is the same. And he has a compelling point there, I have to say. At the end of the day, however, what he comes down to saying is, look, whenever the speech condition is relevant, so we have a program, we believe X, we believe prostitution is bad, so it's okay for us to only give money to people who likewise believe prostitution is bad. That's the condition, and they have to say they believe it and act accordingly. That sort of becomes circular, because then any program you have that has a speech condition, well, the speech condition sort of defines the purpose of the program. So I'm going to go out and give food to folks, but I'm only going to give food to folks who believe in women's rights. Or I'm only going to give food to folks who believe in the Christian God. Or I'm only going to give folks to, you know, food to folks who agree with X. Well, all of a sudden, those ideological conditions are, in fact, part of the purpose of the program. Much like here, we're only going to give out AIDS using groups that agree prostitution is bad. There's a question-begging quality to it, where Scalia says the First Amendment doesn't apply because we've imposed a viewpoint restriction, which means it's now our viewpoint. in short, this is the problem with government speech. It was Scalia's position he took in LMA versus Johans a number of years ago on the beef that's what's for dinner cases, where he thinks that the moment the government takes a viewpoint as its own and decides this is the viewpoint we want to advocate, it's government speech, and any money they spend, they can condition on you agreeing with that government speech because it's just part of the program. So there's my little rant on why the dissent is weird, though it's weird only because earlier precedent is wrong, not because they don't have a good point given the way the precedent is. So what do we make of all this? I guess the short answer is the majority, while not willing to disavow the government speech doctrine in general and sort of the implications of the government speech doctrine, is similarly unwilling to take it to its full and logical conclusion, which would effectively destroy the unconstitutional conditions doctrine. Scalia, on the other hand, seems rather willing to take the government speech doctrine to its full and logical conclusion, effectively destroy the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, or at least make it so trivial that you would almost never see it actually win. But he's not quite willing to say that. So you have two opinions, neither of which are really getting to the crux of the problem that is making it so hard to decide these cases and others like them. Neither of which willing to take the logical extreme of their view. And for now, at least, the pragmatic answer is government can limit the use of its own funds, but if it's going to try to limit the speech of recipients in general, it has to be recipients that are much more closely involved in expressing the government's own views, much like a government spokesperson would be, or a group that we hire to promote and advocate something specifically, rather than merely folks who are peripherally attached to a program that also, through other people, advocated an idea. And that's a very practical answer. It's not ideologically satisfying, though I think it's the better of the two choices to leave some teeth in the unconstitutional conditions doctrine versus destroy it altogether. Obviously, from what I've said, I prefer more teeth in the doctrine than less, so the majority opinion doesn't go far enough, but I think the dissenting opinion goes too far in the other direction. So we're going to be where we were before this case, which is every new case is going to be a bit of a muddle, but at least there's going to have to be some tighter nexus between the federal funds and the thing that you want your recipient to say or not to say and how that works with the federal program. I don't think it will have much of a long-term impact. Future cases will be sort of ambiguous and just as difficult given that neither side has resolved the central contradiction of government speech.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.